Okay, everybody on your best behavior.
Hello, everyone. I will go around and say hi to people, starting with John and Joseph, Paulette. Now I got to put myself back on gallery view so I can see you all. Okay. Yeshe Toki, Jinryu, Mark, Marv, Joketsu, Karen, Vin, Betty, Kemyo, Amelia, Pat, and Ruth Ann. All right. I can't think of anything in particular to announce. Jinryu.
Well, I want to remind everybody that we are approaching the very middle of our fundraiser. And we're trying to raise money just for operating expenses, like paying rent, because we will be going back to our building sooner or later. And supporting our teacher. We had a goal of $5,000 and we are now over $7,000. So I am thrilled, and we have had to increase our goal. So our new goal is $10,000. If you're a member, you would have gotten a letter from us announcing the fundraiser and indicating that a board member was going to be in touch with you. If you're not a member, you probably didn't get the letter and that's only because we didn't have your contact information, but this is really for everybody to participate in. And sincerely, you know, please don't give if you really feel like you can't afford it right now. We totally understand that. But if you can, please help us with a one-time gift, or especially a pledged gift, or maybe an increase in your pledge, so that we can break that $10,000 goal. That would be really wonderful. Thanks.
All right. So, welcome everyone. Today, the talk is, I called it in the newsletter, Sitting for Love. My longer version of the title is Motivation for Practice. What do you love most deeply? So the gist of it is, in order to find motivation for diligent practice, it can help to identify and connect with what you love more than anything else in the whole world. What love makes your life worth living? You know, your children, your grandchildren, animals, nature, music, beauty, justice, knowledge, something else. You know, what arouses an unconditional sense of affinity and inspiration in the core of your being? And then the idea is to practice for the subject of your love, because practice makes you a better person, frankly, makes you better able to access, express, and manifest that love. So, starting off with the problem of motivation, it can be challenging, as we all know, to motivate ourselves for any kind of healthy practice or behavior, whether it's exercise or eating healthy or refraining from, you know, bad, harmful stuff. Whether we're talking about practices with speech or our lifestyle choices, anything that requires effort, you know, I mean, it requires some motivation, and sometimes you may feel it and sometimes you may not. In terms of our practice, meaning Buddhist and Zen practice, there are two aspects to it, not really two, but you could categorize all the different aspects of practice into kind of the formal and literal aspects. So we're talking about a lot of these during our Tuesday study of the nine fields, you know, sitting zazen, doing Dharma study, showing up for Sangha meetings, you know, working with the precepts. So kind of, you know, some has some kind of form. But then the other aspect of our practice, I would say, is formless. It's moment by moment. And I like to characterize it as living deliberately, making the effort each moment of our lives to make choices wherever we have the option of choice, wherever we have choice, to try to make choices that move us to greater peace, liberation, wisdom, compassion. So rather than just living on autopilot according to habit energy or just according to whatever is most pleasant, you know, at each moment we have a choice. We think, what can I do here that would move me and other beings toward greater peace and happiness? Now, in our Soto Zen practice in particular, it can be very difficult to motivate ourselves to bring energy and focus to our zazen, particularly themeless sitting or silent illumination, shikantaza, just sitting, right? So many of us, you know, do some other practices as well to calm the mind, following the breath, metta practice, etc. And at least with those practices, there's a little sense of, you know, there's a task and you try to do the task and you might feel rewarded by being able to do the task, or there's some kind of result from the task. And that's, you know, so it's a little, you know, you still could lack motivation for it, but it's a little easier to find. Where in our meditation practice, our shikantaza, we're even said this isn't even meditation practice. Cultivate no gaining idea, just sit there and be present. So okay, even really inspirational messages about zazen, like zazen is returning home and sitting in peace, which is by Zen master Keizan, can frankly lead us to complacency and dullness. Okay, now I've come home and I'm sitting in peace, now what? Right? It's easy for our zazen to just get kind of slack. And ideally, our zazen and the rest of our practice. So this is, I hesitate to even talk about ideals, because a lot of times then we can just set up like, oh no, I'm supposed to meet this ideal, or I failed to meet this ideal. But the direction we're trying to go is that our zazen would be extremely lively and full of energy. So we end up paying attention to each moment, whether this is in our zazen or in the course of our daily life, as if we're going to die this very day. What if we were going to die today? What kind of attention and appreciation would we pay? And to me, this embodies the ideal. If I hope to reach that level of practice someday where I live each moment as if it is, or each day as if it is my last. And we take the opportunity of this precious, short, rare human life to learn and grow and clean up our karma. But as we all know, this kind of energy and attention isn't easy to maintain at all. If we're able to summon it, sometimes it's not easy to maintain. And frankly, I believe we're wired by natural selection to pay attention to immediate threats or opportunities. How does this relate to, ooh, that looks great, ooh, that's scary. Otherwise, we're like, we kind of, you know, idle, we kind of, you know, tune out, go on autopilot. We're not really wired to pay attention when there's not exciting stuff going on. And there's nothing more boring than our zazen. Our meditation, especially our kind of meditation, is it's like it's engineered to be the most boring activity we have in our whole life. So, you know, we're kind of wired to sit down and go, eh, and just what are we supposed to be motivated by or for? But I would say, like, even when we're sitting like that without this liveliness and appreciation and motivation, there's nothing wrong with that situation. There's nothing, like, morally wrong. It's not like, oh, you bad person, wasting your zazen time. But the way I like to think about it is it's a metaphor that I heard from Kyogen, which was, we're all in harmony with gravity. So when you're sitting zazen, it's right there. But there's a difference in, so falling down and walking and dancing or doing something beautifully athletic are all in harmony with gravity. But the experience of them is very different. And it is very natural to want to walk or want to dance, you know, with this human life, to want to manifest it more, I don't know, in a more satisfying, beautiful way. So how do we motivate ourselves to try to walk or dance as opposed to just kind of, you know, sit through it? And especially because most of us have done in our practice quite a lot of deliberate work to let go of gaining ideas or the agenda of self-improvement. That's part of what we work on. So you can't really turn to that for motivation. And our zazen, unlike many forms of meditation, doesn't have levels, right? It's not like, you know, you can come to me, you can describe your meditation. I say, oh, good, you've attained level 3. You know, now work on level 4. Well, what? This is going to be remain the same from now until the end of your life. It's not terribly motivating in and of itself. It doesn't have any tangible or definable goals. So for us, it comes down to willingness instead of willpower. So we're trying to develop and cultivate our willingness. And we do this in part, this is a little bit of a side digression, but we do this a little bit because willpower, which is a very useful part of our functioning as human beings, willpower creates duality. So there's a self who's calling the shots and cracking the whip, and aspects of ourselves which need to be disciplined and brought into line. So in ordinary activities, this approach might work to some extent, making ourselves exercise, strengthening our muscles. But in our spiritual practice, this creates an obstacle. One part of what we're trying to wake up to is that there is no inherently existing, enduring self-nature. So if you've attained something based on this, you know, sense of self having mastered it or attained it, now you've got this thing that you have to get rid of or see through, which you've actually kind of just reinforced through your whole practice. So we're trying to make some progress, to grow and develop, but without engaging that duality, process of duality. So when we cultivate willingness, we're trying to avoid dividing ourselves against ourselves. So in a grander scale, we become more and more and more familiar and intimate with all aspects of ourselves and try to make friends with it all. Even what we might call the bad parts or the weak parts, the selfish parts, the pathetic parts, the scary parts. We just become more familiar with it all We invite all parts of ourselves to the meditation cushion. Nobody's going to be disciplined. We're all just in this together. And whatever integration and acceptance we manage in our Zazen has profound effects in the rest of our life. I think of Zazen as like a microcosm of our life. How we sit Zazen is how we live the rest of our lives, which sometimes I have to say, I'm not very proud of my Zazen. They're like, huh, oh dear, if that's how I live the rest of my life, then I got some work to do. So there are various ways to cultivate willingness or generate motivation. And this isn't an exhaustive list. So before I get to this argument for why connecting with what you love most deeply is a good way to go about it, I'm just going to cover some of the other ways that we motivate ourselves. And sometimes, honestly, if you can sit or whatever form of practice you're doing, if you can just jump right in without thinking first, and then kind of the simplicity and refuge of the practice itself can be its own motivation. And I think this is awesome. When we can do that, that is great. I experienced this many, many days into a long meditation retreat where I just sit down and I no longer have to like go through all these motions to like get myself to do it and involved and focused. It's just like, it's just there. So if you can do that, that's great. When the practice itself is its own motivation, the relief or the pleasure or the peace or whatever is that's fine. And we also may be motivated by pain, emotional, mental, physical. And then Zazen and other aspects of our practice are often some of our main sources of relief. And that provides great motivation in and of itself. It's actually sometimes easier to practice when we are in pain. Not necessarily all of the practices, but to practice in some way. And then even in Soto Zen, we might be motivated by spiritual ambition, wanting to achieve some level of stillness or insight or behavior. We may want to become more like some spiritual master or teacher that we really admire. Eventually, though, this type of ambition will become an obstacle or a source of disappointment. And that ends up actually deflating our motivation. So that's the tricky part about this. But honestly, in the short term, it's not all that bad. If wanting to achieve some deeper level of meditation or some particular insight keeps you on the meditation cushion, keeps you on the path of practice, that's fine. Well, you deal with jettisoning the problems later. It's better than, in a way, getting stuck in complacency. So, you know, if you're motivated by that kind of thing, that's fine. So just before I get to the using love to motivate us, I don't know if any of you particularly care about this, but I always feel like I need to check, you know, what do the traditional Buddhist teachings have to say about this? Does it offer anything? What's the basis in our tradition? I mean, I guess I feel like it's my responsibility as a teacher. So this isn't an exhaustive list again, but three of the really traditional ways to motivate your practice. The first, and this is not something that we widely use in Chan or Zen, but in many Buddhist traditions, a practitioner who really wants to motivate themselves contemplates how the world is full of misery and practice can liberate us from the cycle of rebirth in this world. And I could try to dress it up and make it sound less negative than it is, but that's what it is. Just looking out at the world, seeing all the injustice and you're going to lose, eventually you're going to lose everything you love and I, you know, whatever. So then you want to be spiritually liberated from dependence on that world. The second is, frankly, encouraging spiritual ambition, particularly by calling to mind the Buddhas and ancestors and their attainments and striving as far as we can to embody them out of gratitude for the opportunity to practice the Dharma. So, you know, just calling to mind, calling out to mind. And then the third that I could think of this morning when I was writing this talk was reminding yourself of the impermanence and brevity of human life by contemplating death or impermanence, either directly, like monks would meditate in eternal ground, essentially a funeral setting, or by reciting a verse like the Five Remembrances, which many of you are familiar with. I am subject to aging. There is no way to avoid aging. I am subject to ill health. There is no way to avoid illness. I am going to die. There is no way to avoid death. Everyone and everything I love will change and I will be separated from them. My only true possessions are my actions and I cannot escape their consequences. So if reciting something like that fires you up, I know I've talked about before the sense of like living each day as if it is my last. Sometimes that gives me some access to some motivation. So the traditional teachings, even though they don't talk about using love the way that I'm going to talk about today, they do recognize the need for motivation. So I'm liking exploring using cultivating motivation based in love, because potentially it can be a source of powerful, sincere, positive, unconditional energy for practice without the creation of duality or requiring a subtle rejection of the world. So when it comes to being motivated by love, I don't know. So just, I guess I'm still on the traditional teachings here. Why isn't it part of the traditional teachings? I think this whole way that makes so much sense to us to consider, you know, here's an individual, how am I motivated to practice? And why am I now sometimes not motivated to practice? And the experience of inspiration. This is a very psychological way of looking at things. And this is a fairly new human innovation, relatively speaking, compared to our 25 plus 100 year old spiritual tradition. So I think this kind of psychological approach is not one that you typically find in the older traditional teachings. But that's why I think our spiritual practice keeps evolving. I would like to think that it keeps getting better, that we keep adding values like equality and egalitarianism and psychological health and well-being and not spiritually bypassing and the appropriateness of emotions and all this kind of stuff that I think it's not at all that it's incompatible with Buddhism. It's just that perhaps in previous generations, they didn't emphasize it. Also though, I suspect that plenty of our spiritual ancestors were motivated by love, but they didn't emphasize it because they didn't want to confuse the issue and encourage us to be motivated by feelings or emotions. So in the Buddhist sense, feelings are really basic feelings of attraction, aversion, or indifference. And then emotions are more complicated. And many of our emotions, anger, longing, envy, jealousy, these kinds of things are very self-centered. And even positive emotions, like romantic love or feeling pride about our accomplishments can be self-centered. And as long as we're motivated by self-centered emotions, we keep acting out our karma and reinforcing our attachment to self. So Buddhism's always been a little bit wary of like encouraging you to like use your emotions, and with some exceptions, or trust them to be a basis for your motivation. So self-centered or self-involved love, I mean, and sometimes honestly, even our love for our children or spouse or family members is far from selfless and unconditional. There may be something sincere in there, but there's a lot of other stuff as well. And so that is not ultimately the kind of love I'm talking about as being a good basis for motivation. On the other hand, if you can motivate yourself, however you can motivate yourself. So if you're able to motivate yourself based on love that isn't entirely selfless, go ahead, do it, whatever works. But the kind of love that I'm talking about as unconditional motivation for practice is deep and wordless. It arises in you when you encounter some aspect of life, independent of thoughts or judgments or circumstances. The mere encounter brings joy and appreciation. Energy rises out of your belly and courses through your chest and radiates out from your heart. And it may bring tears to your eyes. Deep love is a resonance between your being and something outside of your being. And yet that resonance is a sign of connectedness that proves you're not ultimately separate from whatever it is either. And along with this deep love comes gratitude, just like pure gratitude for the existence of that which you love. And it's independent of, it's regardless of any recognition or special consideration of you on the part of that subject of your love. This is not about, you know, needing it to be reciprocal or getting any kind of, you know, kudos or feedback. It's absolutely selfless. I'm just overjoyed that this thing, this being exists. And the subject of your love is precious and beautiful and worth celebrating. It's eminently worthy of your devotion. To serve it, to care for it, even simply to appreciate it, brings your life meaning and joy. And naturally, we are moved to practice in order to become better able to serve or care for or appreciate that subject of our deep love. I would say motivation based in this unconditional love is stable and boundless. Because as long as the subject of our love is present in the world in any way, even if it's reduced to the smallest possible corner of the world, even if it was someday reduced merely to the potential for reemergence, our love is undiminished. So how do we identify and connect with the subject or a subject of our deepest love so we can tap into this boundless and unconditional motivation? This may sound rather abstract, so we'll explore it. Think of times in your life when you felt something of what I described, that arising of energy, of inexplicable and powerful resonance. So this is how we start, with the feeling itself, the experience itself, not by necessarily considering a list of things that you care a lot about, and, you know, looking down to see how you feel about them. When do you remember feeling that feeling, or can you summon some of that feeling right now? You know, something even in this moment, something you can call to mind that causes this love to arise in you. And the subject of your love may or may not have an easily graspable form or name. So we don't have to worry about it. And actually, that's kind of a good thing, because the unconditional love I'm talking about isn't dependent on the existence of any particular person or any particular natural setting or any particular manifestation, skill or beauty or truth. What we love most deeply is what shines through those particular manifestations, is embodied by particular manifestations. So perhaps profound love arises when you are contemplating your child or grandchild's face as they are laughing, or listening to a beautiful piece of music, or standing on a precipice looking over a vast river valley, or watching the bravery and resilience of Indigenous people protecting their land, or witnessing acts of compassion, or being near a horse or a dog or a bird, or sitting zazen in a powerfully silent zendo with 70 other people. Then we ask ourselves, what unconditional thing is shining through at that moment? And in a way, it's limiting even to put words to it. Ultimately, we might just say, that's life shining through, or that's the ineffable, or I don't know. But each of us is also an individual with karma and makeup and personalities. And so we have particular resonances. So for me, when I go through this process of exploration and examination of my deepest love, I notice how I am profoundly and inexplicably moved by what, at least right now, at this point in my life, I can best describe as beauty. And this beauty manifests in infinitely many ways. Complex, self-balancing, self-sustaining ecosystems. Just absolutely mind-bogglingly beautiful. A tiny songbird outside my window. I always, something about birds, just, they're like little jewels. It's just absolutely perfect. You know, eyes and beaks, everything evolved to just a particular niche. Their feathers are like, I don't know, like a cloak of jewels. A progression of chords and a piece of traditional melancholic folk music. Melodies that have been handed down through the generations and convey something deeply, commonly human. So when I notice beauty, there's a change in my whole being, an opening and a relaxation in the area of my heart, a deeper breath, an expansion of awareness beyond my small self. And as I contemplate the subject of my deepest love, which isn't really graspable, but it's something that I can recognize, motivation arises. In particular, for me, a vow takes form to protect beauty from mindless destruction. This is something that just clarified itself for me recently. For me, this is my deep concern. so this can inspire and energize and focus my practice and Sazen. It's not enough to be motivated by for myself anymore. Once upon a time, I had a lot of misery to get through, and I was still motivated to do that. It's not enough to be motivated to achieve some arbitrary goal. Yeah, okay, well, I guess I could get better at it. I guess I could get more, have more equanimity or something, but all right. I mean, it's not highly motivating, but to be motivated out of love, motivated out of something outside of ourselves to better serve and appreciate, that's pretty wonderful. So just in closing, on reflection, I realized motivation based in love may be reflected in our traditional teachings after all. And on more reflection, I might find more examples. But I thought about the idea, the ideal of the Bodhisattva caring for beings as a mother protects her only child, or a parent protects their only child. So that completely just, selfless, it's not even selfless, selfish doesn't even enter into it. Just you happily lay down your life to protect your only child. Just wouldn't even think about it. So that kind of love, that kind of unconditional love. And usually I think, though, we contemplate that teaching, we hear about that description of that great Bodhisattva love and that great Bodhisattva vow, and we think, okay, so now the Bodhisattvas attained some, great level of saintliness, and because they are so selfless now, they've evolved this warmth and compassion for beings, for all these beings. And to some extent, that's true. That kind of unconditional and extending it to everyone is something to work toward. But maybe we can enter this practice from the other end, from the love part, from the, what do we love as a parent loves their only child? And then kind of enter through that motivation. And then, maybe over time with practice that love gets expanded farther. So I will leave it there. And hope that you have some questions. And just if nobody pops up immediately, we can just give it a minute for some reflection. Sometimes it takes a little while on Zoom. And if there's nothing, then I'll have some questions for you. Betty.
Thank you for that. That was really helpful, but also raises questions too. So helpful. Good. To a certain extent. Thanks. So I don't really know how to ask this question because I'm not really sure what I'm asking, but the feeling that is evoked in those moments of pure love, whatever that sort of situation is, but how can, and forgive my inability to articulate this well, how can I use that feeling as motivation for sitting Zazen without meditating on the feeling or the thing? I don't know that that's clear. Does it make any sense?
I think basically that you would meditate on the feeling a little bit.
Okay.
I guess when we're doing that and we're recalling, the subject of our deepest love and searching for motivation or something, that technically that's not shikantaza. But that's fine. Just like I was saying, people sometimes, you sit and you follow your breath for a while, or you do some metta, or you do a body scan or something to kind of get yourself in the right frame, the right state to do it.
Okay.
And when I know, as most of my Dharma talks are really for myself. And so my thoughts have been like, why is so unfocused and so having not been to a long meditation retreat for a long time, which usually, you know, fires up that motivation. I'm like, oh. So I was looking for that. I'm looking for, like, how can I revitalize my sitting? I mean, it's not like, not to sit there and judge it and say this is bad and terrible, but there's that kind of, I want to be engaged in it. I don't want to just be tuning out and enduring it. I want to get something more out of it. And so, yeah, then it's like, as I sit down, then I might recall that, or as my mind wanders, it's almost like a touchstone in a way to come back to, like, what really matters. I don't want to just sleepwalk through this life. Because of this love, this is why I want to be awake. So
thank you. That's helpful. I think I just want permission to do
yes, it. Yes. I know. Because we're like, no, you're not supposed to be trying to do anything, but, like, except for sometimes. I just think it's good to be clear that, you know, that there's a difference, and just be, for those of us who are wanting to cultivate that Shikantaza, just sitting, to just recognize that sometimes we need to let go of all of it and just let it be.
What I love, I would say, is communicating, even if I'm not using so-called senses, just the part of me that's alive. If I take in a bird song, and for me, a sazen is a way of communicating. It's recognizing I'm in this packaging, this body form. So I'm in this moment of, in a way, utilizing that as the relationship that in the moment I'm communicating, without going to the checklist of don't get drowsy, you know, watch my posture, but just it is communicating. Thank you for this is a useful talk.
That's a beautiful example. Jinryu.
I just love hearing about all these different experiences, and I think it's hard to talk about, as has been pointed out, because it is just so mysterious and such a different way, at least for me, such a different way for me to think. But one of the things that you said that was that felt validating for me is it's the act of bowing in front of the Buddha. And broadening that just a bit, the forms that we do, and I know a lot of people curl their lip at the forms that we do. But there's something to me about recognizing whatever we think the Buddha is, that there is a power that is far larger than I am. And if I can carry that with me through the day, that to me is a motivator for sitting on a regular basis, because there is an element of communication to it. There's an element of listening to it, as in listening to all the sounds around me. But, you know, I came into Buddhism. I was not young when I got here. And this very idea, you know, it's this whole thing about this power that is so much bigger than I am. It almost feels a lot of times that it doesn't have anything to do with me. And that's when it gets very powerful for me, that this whole life exists outside of me, and just the ability to observe it is precious. And so sitting down for me is a way of pausing and elongating the time that I have left. Because to your point, I think you're the one who said this, I don't want to squander it. I don't have that much time left. And I definitely don't want to squander it. So Zazen is a way of doing whatever the opposite of squandering is. I don't know. It's like I'm hugging it, but I'm not hugging it. I'm not attaching to it. You know what I mean? Anyway, that's what I'm thinking about.
Thank you. And I think that's where, you know, as people are pointing out, it's difficult to define or put words to. And even if you do, like, it's not going to last. Like, next month, next year, I'll phrase it differently, right? So I stuck some words on it, but it doesn't help that much. But it's the feeling, right? So we don't have to name necessarily what it is that we are responding to, but it's that feeling of, you know, again, it's hard to describe, but at least it's a little easier to describe the experience of that connection, of that intimacy, of that resonance, that love, devotion. Alice.
Hi. Can you go over, you mentioned something about, you know, practice and self-improvement and how that's not a long-lasting kind of motivator. Can you go over that?
Ironically, you know, our practice does give us a lot of tools to make changes in our lives. So I think it is, we kind of go on this dual path. So we try to do better. We adopt the precepts. We try to live according to the precepts. We try to be mindful of our behavior. We try to, you know, like my nine fields, you do your karma work. You try to accept and come to terms with your stuff and learn how to act more skillfully and all that. And or get through our own spiritual pain, which I had in great amounts when I came to practice. And I would have been fooling myself if I said somehow I'm not motivated by getting through that spiritual pain. That was my main motivator for a long time. So that's, in a way, it's fine. But I guess, ironically, then at the same time, like our true liberation, what is really lasting and transformative, is seeing that we never lacked anything to begin with, that we have everything we need, that the self doesn't even exist in the way that we think. There's no one to be blamed. There's no one to take the credit. We're just along for the ride. You know, and that, if we're too caught up in the self-improvement piece, then we don't open up to that other part, which then we still have to work on our lives. It's not like, oh, look, I'm perfect the way I am. But yeah, so that it gets to be limiting. And I've talked about this in other contexts where, you know, part of what we're doing is building faith in our own Buddha nature. And as long as, you know, we're so caught up in our own limitations and karma and fears and inhibitions and all this, that we can't accept our Buddha nature.
So relative versus absolute then.
Yes, exactly. And then, you know, this is what ideally what we do in our long meditation retreats is let go of all the details. And sometimes people can't. Sometimes you've got stuff coming up and that's just, you're going to just sit and deal with your karma, and that's what that retreat's going to be like for you. But to whatever extent we can, we set aside, don't worry about what you're going to do next for your job. Don't worry about your relationship problems. Don't worry about your financial situation. Don't worry about the fact that, you know, you're depressed most of the time. Just put it all aside and be here. Which is like, what? And it's, you know, sometimes cultivating that other side. So we also call that the samadhi power versus karma relationship aspects of our practice. Continue.
Another thing about this that to me was very mysterious when I went to my first retreat of any length where there was a real emphasis on silence. And by that, I mean the first couple of retreats, a short one and another one, I sort of muddled my way through. But I went to my first Rohatsu at Great Bow, and again, you know, this to me is connected to letting go of self, and it was just this feeling I had, and the motivation sounded like, what's going to happen next? You know, going there in there in the morning far earlier than I would ever be there in my regular life, and sitting down excited to think about what's going to happen next. And it was the love and appreciation I had for the other people in the room sitting next to me. That's a very cold room in the wintertime. And I felt like they were keeping me warm, among other things. But they were giving me direction. I have no sense of direction. So if I saw that person, I knew I was directly across from them. That was very powerful for me. That's when Sangha became very important for me.
Thank you. Marv.
I'm thinking through you. Your talk was so stimulating. I think that I had probably 300 comments. But as I'm listening to everybody, I think we probably all have a whole series of motivations, and maybe at different times we tap into different ones. But I kind of bet that in every one of us, the something that we love and expect nothing necessarily in return out of, but love unconditionally, is the Dharma. And I think there are times maybe when, for me, when things get too riled up and anxious for me to connect with other things that are important to me, it's the faith in terms of trust in the Dharma. It's always a motivation. I don't know if that sounds too woo or what, but there it is.
No, and ultimately, kind of when you trace it all back, it all kind of gets back to the same mystery, you know? And what you're talking about makes me think about a little bit what Jinryu mentioned as well, which is when we get familiar with the forms And by that, I mean, you know, everything that we make a habit of doing as part of the Dharma, whether it's study or meditation or mindfulness or coming to this Dharma talk or bowing in the Zendo or, you know, chanting or it's, for me, it's like a way of aligning ourselves with that love, even when we can't feel it, perhaps. And I know for myself, I was so, for a while in practice, so in so much emotional angst and pain that I, when I contemplated the Dharma, I didn't feel, I felt extremely ambivalent. I'm like, I don't know. I don't know if this is going to work. I don't know. I'm up to the task. In some ways, this made me more miserable than I was before, because now I'm examining my shit. I don't know. But then it's like, sometimes I say, well, what if I look back on the, you know, this, these years of practice, and I just, I think I turn the sound off. What if I just turned off the, like, what if you're just like, you were watching my life and you didn't hear all that chatter in my head? You'd see me getting up and going into the Zendo, and you'd see me doing this practice and put aligning myself with this practice. And it's like, there's a deeper truth there than this, that chatter in my head. A sign that I really did love something, even if I didn't feel like it at the time. Was capable. Any last comments or questions? Anybody want to share what they love? Did anybody here get motivated, you know, use this, relate to this idea? I'm always curious too about just where it comes out for people in that kind of individual way, where it comes awake. All right. Well, I will wrap it up then. Abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water, the mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, maha prajna paramita. Thank you everyone for coming. Have a good day.